All right. Today is week two of our series in Lent on divestment and reinvestment. If you weren't here last week when I talked about divestment, we talked about the story of Abraham and Sarah. All right. These are the parents of three faiths, by the way, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Abraham and Sarah. We talked about how God called them. God calls Abraham and Sarah out of their homeland into a new land, all right? He calls them away from everything they knew, absolutely everything they knew. He said he was going to take them to a different place altogether. It was both literal and metaphorical. The payoff would be not just that they would get their place, but that God would bless them, that they would be made a great nation, and that their name would be great, and that they would bless everybody around them, not just in the local vicinity, but the whole earth. God would bless everybody through Abraham and Sarah. We talked about how all of these promises that Abraham and God made to each other were part of what we called a covenant. A covenant. We said that both Abraham and God had important parts to play. It wasn't just a unilateral sort of thing or one-sided. They both came together to form this covenant. God promised to give Abraham and Sarah land and kids and more kids. He promised to make them great, but Abraham and Sarah had to give to get. They had to divest themselves. That's where that term comes in. Divest. They had to divest themselves of everything they thought they knew, what they knew about life, what they knew about success, what they knew about the world, what they knew about what they were going to be and do. They had to rethink the very purpose of life. They had to reorientate, we might say, what they understood to be good and what they understood to be true. This meant, first and foremost, that they were going to have to change. That's the simple point of the matter. They were going to have to change in some really fundamental and important way. They were going to have a good look at the world differently, at what it meant to be successful, to live the good life, at what they were supposed to be and do as individuals and people. This was what made up the covenant between them and God, was this divestment and then reinvestment in a new way of being in the world. But there was a problem. It was a little problem. Abraham and Sarah didn't have any kids, right? They didn't have any kids. God says, I'm going to make you into a great nation. And they're like, how? We got no kids, not a single one. And it's not like they were teenagers anymore. All right? Sarah apparently was 90 years old when God made this promise. Abraham was closer, he was pushing 100. Personally, I can't imagine. But since God promised it, it happened. Sarah ended up giving birth to a son just like God said she would. And they named him Isaac. He was supposed to be the beginning of this long line of people. All right, a massive nation. As many as the stars in the sky, the sand on the seashore, one as great and as great in importance as it was in number. But then God did something weird. He did something that really makes no sense at all. He tells Abraham to go up onto this mountain and kill Isaac. Go up. Sacrifice your son. Just do it. Sacrifice the one person in the world that makes this covenant work at all. You see, without Isaac, everything would supposedly fall apart. Isaac was the key that made the blessings and the promises work. And what does God do? But he tells Abraham, wake up, kill him. I told you all last week that we were going to be exploring the story of Abraham and Sarah during this period of Lent. This is where we're going to start, with Abraham killing Isaac. If you want to follow along, it's in chapter 22 of Genesis, that first book in the Bible in front of you. Here's what it says. After these things, God tested Abraham. He said to him, Abraham. And Abraham said, Here I am. God said, Take your son, your only son Isaac, the one whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains that I will show you. So Abraham rose early in the morning. He saddled his donkey and took two of his young servants with him and his son Isaac as well. He cut the wood for the burnt offering, and he set out and went to the place in the distance that God had shown him. And on the third day, Abraham looked up and saw the place far away. Then Abraham said to his young men, Stay here with the donkey. The boy and I will go over there. We will worship, and then we will come back to you. Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on his son Isaac, but he carried the fire and the knife himself. So the two of them walked on together. Isaac then said to his father, Father! And Abraham said, Here I am, my son. The fire and the wood are here, but where is the lamb for a burnt offering? Then Abraham said, God himself will provide the lamb for a burnt offering. So the two of them walked together. When they came to the place that God had shown him, Abraham built an altar there and laid the wood in order. He bound his son Isaac and laid him on top of the altar, on top of the wood. Then Abraham reached out his hand and took the knife to kill his son. But the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. And he said, Here I am. He said, Do not lay your hand on the boy or do anything to him, for now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son. And Abraham looked up and saw a ram caught in a thicket by its horns. Abraham went and took the ram and offered it up as a burnt offering instead of his son. So Abraham called that place, The Lord Will Provide. As it is said to this day, on the mount of the Lord, it will be provided. I can't tell you how many problems this story has caused over the years. There have been a lot of them. For starters, we might ask, why would God ask anyone to sacrifice their child to him? I mean, the Old Testament is filled with commands that the Hebrew people not sacrifice children. That's what other people did for their gods, but the Hebrews were supposed to be different, right? Don't worship other gods, we're told. Don't sacrifice your kids, we're told. And yet here, Genesis 22, God asks Abraham to sacrifice his son, his one and only son, Isaac. And it's not like Isaac was very happy about it either. All right? This isn't some thrilling story of Saint Isaac, the first martyr, or something like this. It's really a straight-up horror film. The kid has no clue. Abraham doesn't seem inclined to tell him either. Instead, what he does, when Isaac asks, where is the lamb for the slaughter? Abraham, he hedges. He says kind of lamely, God will provide. I can just imagine sort of the music playing in the background here. For whatever reason, it sounds a lot like Jaws. Dudum, dudum. God will provide. And you're like, yeah, we've seen this show before. And so, I mean, Abraham even has to tie up Isaac, right? He has to tie him up. You can imagine the struggle that led to him having to tie him up. So he ties him up to get him on the altar. The text doesn't come out and say this, but I think it's pretty clear that Isaac doesn't like the idea that he's about to die as some kind of arbitrary and possibly blasphemous act of worship. I mean, really, how cruel do you think it was that his own dad is about to kill him and he sends him up carrying the wood for his own fire? That's just kind of brutal. It's all sorts of wrong, maybe. Maybe what's worse in this passage, though, is that Abraham doesn't even seem to care. There's nothing to suggest that Abraham is flustered at all about what God asks him to do. He wakes up in the morning, packs his bags, gets on a donkey, starts going up a hill. It's just like another Monday at the office. There's nothing there to say that he's, like, upset. God just told me to kill my son. All right? Maybe the closest we get to any kind of Abrahamic remorse here is the fact that he doesn't have the heart to tell Isaac the truth. But wouldn't it have been a little nice if he had? It would certainly have made, I think, maybe interpreting this passage a little easier. Isaac could have agreed to the whole scheme after all, and then we would have that lovely tale of martyrdom. But he doesn't. Abraham just remains silent. And we're left trying to figure out what the point of the story is, besides being a really strange and wildly inappropriate tale about some guy's faith. And I'm getting down because I need my phone, because on my phone is what I think is actually a better interpretation of this whole passage. A better, a fantastic one, we might say. I'm going to pull it up. I should have had this with me, but I didn't. So take this as your time to, here we go. You know this song, right?
Well, God said to Abraham, kill me a son. Abe said, man, you must be putting me on. No, Abe said, what? God said, you can do what you want, Abe, but the next time you see me coming, you better run. Well, he said, all right, where you want this killing done? God said, on Highway 61.
All right. So Bob Dylan. All right. All right, by the way, Ken and I were having a discussion about Dylan the other day. Actually, it was a discussion about, are there just like some like good songwriters, some people really gifted at songwriting, some people really gifted at, you know, performing it. And we decided that was more often than not the case, that you have people that are really good at performing, people really good at songwriting, and it's a rare combination. It's like the Freddie Mercury effect if you got both of them. All right, of course, that's only if you really like Freddie Mercury, but he's great. All right, Bob Dylan is sort of like fantastic songwriter, but if you heard him, some of it has to do with the fact that he probably smoked like 90 packs a day for 70 years. But, you know, he's not the best singer, but his songs are great, all right? At least whatever they mean, it feels great. All right, so this is Dylan. Highway 61 is the blues highway. All right, so if you don't know much about the blues, Highway 61, all right, it runs from New Orleans, like the home of jazz, home of the blues, starting at the south, right, and goes all the way up through the heartland, follows the Mississippi, all right, follows the Mississippi, goes all the way through the heartland of America, through Memphis, Highway 61 was there when MLK got shot, all right. Highway 61 is supposedly the place where Robert Johnson, the so-called father of the blues himself, supposedly sold his soul to the devil and then paid the price for it when he was only a few years later, at the age of 27. This is like the epitome of bluesiness, all right, Highway 61. It goes all the way up through Duluth, Minnesota, and then into Canada, all right? Towards the end, it actually passes through Bob Dylan's hometown of Hibbing, Minnesota. Hibbing. It was a mining town, all right? 80 miles south of the Canadian border. All right, for Bob Dylan, this is where it all began, Highway 61, all right? It might be where he thinks it's all going to end, too, all right? The song's a weird one, Highway 61 Revisited, what we just said. Even for Dylan, it's a little weird. It probably helps, though, to know that Dylan's dad was, Dylan's whole family, they were Jewish, and Dylan's dad was named Abraham. So it gives that first verse, what we just heard, a little bit different meaning. God said to Abraham, kill me a son. Abe said, man, you just be putting me on. God said, no. Abe said, what? God said, you can do what you want, Abe, by the next time you see me coming, you better run. Well, Abe said, where do you want this killing done? God said, out on Highway 61, right? By the way, there's more thinking twice there from Abe than there is in the Bible. And so, but we can't help ourselves, I think. Highway 61 is where it all begins. For the blues, for Bob Dylan, for Abraham, Isaac, Sarah, and the promise God makes with them to bless them and all the nations around them, everything begins here at the crossroads of Highway 61 and the mountain of sacrifice. The entire history of Abraham, Sarah, Judaism, Christianity reads like a series of tests. But none of them comes even close to the sacrifice of Isaac. Here, Abraham's faith is made sure in the most extreme way imaginable. But the same thing happens with God's faithfulness too. When God finally does replace Isaac with a ram, we get the picture that God's in this for good. The covenant, this is the real deal, but it's not going to be easy. There are some sacrifices that have just got to be made. So what we see here, I think, in the story of Abraham and Isaac is a test, yes, of Abraham's character, but it's a test of what David Brooks, who is this columnist for the New York Times, calls a confrontation with the big me. I should have titled this sermon, The Big Me, because this is what it's about. You see, that this Abraham, this test of Abraham is to see if he realizes that he can't go it alone, that there's only one way that he's going to become a great nation and a blessing to the world, and that's if he trusts God to lead him. Maybe there's more there to Abraham's promise, that statement he makes to Isaac, that pathetic little statement, God will provide. Maybe there's more there than it seems to be. Maybe Abraham does realize that there's this little thing called sin that sits like a cancer in the middle of our souls, and it eats away at us. Its deepest lie is that we can do it alone. That if we just put our minds to it, if we devote the necessary energy, if we pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps, then we can do it. We can succeed. We can be anything we want to be. We can be good, successful, beautiful, rich. Maybe Abraham realizes that he doesn't know everything in this moment, that he can't fly through life on his own inertia, that he needs somebody else to guide him, to strengthen him, to help him out. But this would mean that the story of Abraham's sacrifice of Isaac is not really just a story about faith. It's a story about how we're all dependent upon someone outside of ourselves. It's about how we all need someone to help us to see what is right, what's true, what's beautiful, what's good in the first place. And so that person, the story tells us, that person is God. But this is not really what we're taught today. And I don't mean by folks who argue against religion or Christianity or anything like that. I mean by folks like Dr. Seuss. Like Dr. Seuss. All right, I'm not joking. The big me mentality here is so much the way we look at ourselves and we think about our lives and what it takes to live them that it's even begun to seep into our children's books. All right, I'll read a little bit. Congratulations, today is your day. You're off to great places. You're off and away. You have brains in your head. You have feet in your shoes. You can steer yourself any direction you choose. You're on your own, and you know what you know, and you are the guy who will decide where to go, and you will succeed. Yes, you will indeed. 98.75% guaranteed. I mean, who would have thought that Dr. Seuss would be one of the most common college graduation presents? All right? But books like Oh, the Places You'll Go, where this comes from, all right, fuel exactly the kind of big me mentality that goes against what the story of Abraham and Isaac is teaching us. What it means to be in relationship with a God who redefines how the world works, what is good, what is beautiful in it. You see, maybe the thing that gives away books like, oh, The Places You'll Go, is the number of times they use the word you or I or me. This is big me on steroids, all right? Before, some illustrations for you. Before Franklin Roosevelt suffered his polio attack, he was kind of shallow and arrogant. That's how people describe him. After the attack, though, people noticed he had changed. When he would speak on stage, you could see him gripping the podium, and both hands would be shaking the entire time. They'd be shaking because they were keeping up his weight, what his legs couldn't do. When he was done speaking, all these women would come and they would surround him. They had large skirts on, and it was supposed to be in some sort of a congratulatory sense, but that was just sort of the show. The real purpose for them was so that their skirts could hide how he had to hobble off stage. FDR went from having a big me mentality to something else. He began to humbly and gratefully accept even the most menial forms of help. He never talked about his attack of polio, never talked about it, but he suffered it. This was a man who was humiliated by it, but it led him to be a better person, one an entire nation could watch, could listen to help them through one of the most terrible periods in not just American, but world history. When the elder George Bush, George H.W., practiced his speeches, he would instinctively cross out all the I's that his speechwriters would write into them. One day, his staff successfully got him to leave a few in, and he gave the speech, and then he got a call from his mom, who said, "George, you're starting to talk about yourself again." You see, George had been raised to never promote himself, to always deflect, to resist the notion that he was somehow more than the people around him, more than the people who influenced him and the people he served. He was taught to not think that way. David Brooks, this columnist I talked about, shares a Gallup poll from the 1950s which surveyed high school seniors. In the 50s, 12% of high school seniors thought of themselves as very important. 12%. Take a guess at what the number was in 2005. 80. Close to 98. Maybe it's 98 now. And so, 80%. 80%. Some of you are in Girl Scouts, right? Handbooks. The old Girl Scout handbook used to preach self-sacrifice, self-effacement. If you wanted to find true happiness, it said, then you needed to fight against the desire to have people think about you. Not just well about you, but about you. Stop making it about you. The new Girl Scout handbook, and I imagine this is also for the Boy Scouts too, you're told in there to pay more attention to yourself, not less. Put yourself center stage. Follow your dreams. Follow your hearts. Be true to yourself. This isn't the gospel, by the way, of the Me Too movement. This isn't that. This is the gospel of self-trust. Self-trust. It's the opposite of the Abraham and Sarah and Isaac story. The opposite. Abraham learned on that mountain that he's not the center of the universe, that the answers to this thing called life aren't found within us, but outside of us. They're in our attention to God and to others. He learned that if this thing was going to work, if true blessing, true blessedness were going to come for both him and his family and then the world, then he was going to have to trust that God probably had some good wisdom on how to go about the matter. That Abraham shouldn't go it alone, but should instead walk with the creator of the universe. Maybe this all meant that trusting God, trust him to know what he was doing, when he asked him to sacrifice Isaac. Maybe God really would provide. Maybe that's what Abraham was learning. If anything, he learned that faith and trust come at a cost. And that cost is often ourselves. And the belief that we are the center of our world, that everything revolves around us. So I asked all of you last Sunday, if you were here, to begin thinking about what you needed to divest, like we said earlier. What is God calling you to give up, to change, to rethink, to replace? What's at the top of your mountain of sacrifice? You all have those river stones. These are supposed to be your divestments, what you divest. So what I want you to do, I want you to close your eyes. You can go ahead and do it. Hold that stone in your hand, warm it up, close your eyes. For the moment of reflection, I want you to divest what you need into these stones. Consider what God is calling you, has been calling you to give up, to change, to rethink, to replace, and then graft that into your stone. Make it specific. It doesn't have to be straight up the big me, straight up arrogance or pride or something like that. A couple weeks ago, we talked about how there's a lot of stuff, a lot of people who suffer from deep insecurities. Maybe that's you. Are you constantly afraid of what people are thinking about you? Do you think you're unforgivable? Do you wonder why anyone would want to be around you? If so, graft that into your stone. Maybe you're always tempted to judge yourself according to the folks around you. Maybe you're thankful that you're not like them. Graft that into your stone. Maybe you're more like me. Maybe your happiness is directly tied to your accomplishments. Maybe your self-worth is wrapped up in your work. Does everything have to be a competition for you because your very happiness depends upon it? Must every week be more impressive, more successful than the last week? If that's you, give that to your stone. Ask yourself, what is God calling me to divest? Then place it there, right on your stone. Take your time. And then when you're done, bring your stone up here to the altar. There's a place, you probably saw it. Place it on top of the rocks that are already here. And what we're going to build together is what's called a cairn of divestment. A cairn is a burial mound, a memorial, a reminder about where we've been, where we're going to go. It's a witness to the journey of trust that we're taking together as we move deeper and deeper into Lent, closer, closer to the cross. On Good Friday, we're going to metaphorically bury these stones with Jesus. And then we're going to trust that come Easter morning, Sunday morning, he'll roll these stones away too and set us free from them, raising us to new life. So as Darren plays, take your time. And then when you're ready, feel free to come place your stone up on the cairn.